Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
We can make our own things. But if there are things that remain tangible only to us and maybe even a handful of us, it still remains marginal.
That is Charlton McElwain. On this episode of New Books in Technology, I'm your host, Jasmine McNeely. The book is Black Software, the Internet and Racial Justice from AfroNet to Black Lives Matter. But one of the first things we always like to do on New Books in Technology is ask about the author. So who is Charlton McElwain?
I am currently a vice provost for faculty engagement and development at New York University, where I've also been a professor of media, culture, and communication for about 20 years. I study issues of race, politics, and media, including technology. And so that is my space.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get to studying media, politics, and race?
Wow, that goes right back to my first career, which was in politics. I went to college in Oklahoma, ended up in graduate school at the University of Oklahoma. And one of the things that I did at that time was got involved in Democratic Party politics. Mm-hmm. And the first campaign I worked on was a congressional campaign against J.C. Watts, who was at the time the first African-American Republican
right?
Yeah. Elected to Congress from south of the Mason-Dixon line. And there's some very interesting dynamics in that particular context had been to do with controversial racial political ads in the political contest before that year and during that. And so that's really what got me interested in the sort of cross-section between politics and race. And for the first 10, 12 or so years of my academic career, that was really the focus of my attention, how race impacts political campaigns and how political candidates mobilize race for their strategic advantage.
How did you move into the race and technology or race and internet and politics space?
That was a long development for me. So it really began as I was finishing a first book called Race Appeal, which was about those issues of political campaigns and race. And what I started to find, and this was 2008, 2009, 2010, was that the people that I was conversing with, the people that were interested in issues around civil rights, political campaigning, equal opportunity, were all moving into this digital space. That's where the work was happening, even amongst my academic colleagues and peers who were on social media and digital networks, talking about their work, making connections to policy communities, to activist communities. And so for me, I was, number one, I was reluctant to come into that space and remember first getting on Twitter and thinking, why would anyone use this channel? What is it for? It seems like an absolute waste of time. But I started to become interested more so in the medium itself and in the technology and what it had and what it offered for the kind of political action, political organizing that I would see happening. This, of course, is around the same time that you have the Obama election. And so the outpouring of electoral action, as well as all of the racial dynamics that were at play, and the real sort of first time in a highly engaged way, excuse me, where digital media, the internet, data in a very big way were playing a role in that election. So that's how I got started. But for me, I had to, what that meant was retool a bit, because this was not a space that I was familiar with. I was not a technology person in terms of what I'd studied. And so it took me a few years of just reading, exploring, learning new things about how to, at least in a rudimentary way, learn how to code, learn how to collect and read different kinds of data. And so that's how I got into it. And then ultimately, we end up around 2014, 2015, with Ferguson, Missouri. And then that's when a lot of things changed with that moment in time, the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement, which then spearheaded everything that I've done since.
You've talked about how your interest in the Black Lives Matter movement has kind of like spurred your writing of Black software. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It was the sort of moment. And so, like many of the rest of us, that movement, took me by storm. And to see the level of organizing and sustained political action through 2014, 15, and after, it really made me curious to understand how did that happen and what was so different about this new digital and technological environment that enabled those activists and organizers who played a role in the Black Lives Matter movement, what gave them that opportunity to do something that had not been accomplished really since the late 60s and early 70s, which was to catapult issues of race, racial inequality, racial discrimination, and particularly in the criminal justice system at the forefront of public discussion. So I wanted to know how that happened. And that's where Black software began. That was the question that first motivated me and what I was really set out to answer, though the book turned out very differently.
You'd say that Black software is two books in one.
It is. And it took me a while to get to that point. I made the decision early on that, what I mostly wanted to do in this book was to tell a story, because what I found was that I discovered some things for myself that I had never known, that were surprising to me, and that really changed my outlook in thinking about the relationship of Black folks and technology. And so really what I set out to do was tell a story, but the more I unraveled things, the farther back in time I went, there were two stories that emerged, and I felt compelled to tell them both because they were both related to each other, although they were in some ways different. And those stories really had to do with our more recent history And then the other with our longer history. And so when I started to write the book or started to do research on the book, as I said, my first question was really about Black Lives Matter. How did it come about? How did this sort of digital activism, as it were, begin? What were its historical roots? And I thought, you know, this was going to be a story that was, you know, fairly present oriented. And if we went back in history much at all, it was to a history that I thought I knew, which emerged in the early and mid 90s with the advent of the World Wide Web. And I remember when the, you know, the moment when that all changed. So the first sort of discovery, if you will, for me was to find a whole host of African-Americans in the early 90s, mid 90s, who really played a central and outsized role in the development of what we know now as the internet. And so that was my first sort of discovery and story that I wanted to tell about this group of folks that we have never heard about, given that from, you know, even up till now, and certainly in the 90s, the story about African Americans and technology was a story about the quote unquote digital divide. The story about Black folks who did not have access to or much less using new internet technology, and the disconnect between Black folks and white folks in their use of technology. And so our story, our narrative, historically, is really about Black folks who don't have access and had nothing to do with that time and that technology. And so to discover a world where that was entirely different, to discover that, number one, that millions of African Americans had access to computers, had access to modems, were using them at their homes. That was what set me off and wanted to understand who were these people. Because what all we heard before then was about all the others, the folks on that other side of the divide. But who were these folks who were plugged in, tuned in, creating, producing? And that was a story that I discovered early and got into with a number of people who had so much to do with a history that I don't think is an understatement to say really defined and shaped what the modern internet is. So that was the first story that I wanted to tell, had to tell. But even as I discovered and told that story, I remember interviewing a person I had found just sort of lurking around the internet and searching around for people sort of in that early 90s moment. And I came across a man named William Morrell. And so I decided to call him up and talk to him and ask him. He was the first person that I had ever seen the words black software connected to. And so I wanted to understand, A, what he meant by those two words. And the way that conversation started was me asking the question that I had asked so many other folks, which was very simply, when did you first get online? And I thought, you know, I knew the answer to that question for most of them, which in my mind had to be in the early to mid 90s with the advent of the web. And so I asked William that question, and he kind of hemmed and hawed a little bit and ultimately said, well, I first got online in 1978. And I remember stopping for a minute and pausing and then asking the question, you know, what on earth do you mean being online in 1978? And so he told a story, and it was a story about him working at IBM and IBM, who had built essentially an internet for its employees to use when their technicians went out on the road to help solve problems for their clients and deal with their computers, and was a way for the technicians to be in real-time connection with folks in the office and supervisors and whatnot. And so I was fascinated both by that story, but really what it told me even beyond that is that there was something of significance about African Americans and technology even further back than that period in the 90s where I thought it all began. And so the more that I started then tracking down that story, what else is happening in the 80s, in the 70s, then ultimately back into the 60s. And that's what led me to that story, which is book two in the book. And that really has everything to do with the origins, the simultaneous origins and engagement of the 60s civil rights movement and the development of computing, which again, when we look at our current history of technology, when we look at our current history of civil rights, the story is that those two things are very separate stories. And what I discovered and found was that they weren't two separate stories, that they were intimately intertwined, engaged, and really that the two were on a collision course with each other from their very beginnings. And so that's the story that is a second book, if you will, in Black Software.
What are the implications of always coming to the discussion of Black folks and technology from a deficiency standpoint?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think that deficiency, and you know, and Andre and I talk frequently about this, and it's one of the reasons why his book is so fascinating as well, is that when you start from that deficiency perspective with respect to Black folks and technology, you simply miss a giant, not just a story, but a history. We've told ourselves that this thing called the internet developed in the absence of Black people, when the actual reality is that it developed because of Black people and because of Black people's cultural engagement with this technology. And so you can't see that. And when someone like Andre focuses on something like a Black Twitter in the present and stretches out its cultural production, its cultural context back through and connecting to, the moment of Black blogging that came before it and all the things that were happening in the early 90s in terms of Black cultural production and online spaces. That's so foreign to people because that is part of our history that we do not know. But what we can see in many areas of contemporary digital life is the imprint of Black people, of Black culture. And so one has to ask, where did that come from? It did not come from just nowhere. So if you don't have that framework and all that you are told is, Black people have no connection to, or we're not at the center or core of this technology, then you miss what I say is not the history of Black people and technology, but you miss the history of technology and you miss the history of the internet and how it actually developed.
Why the choice of software versus hardware?
Yeah, the titling and the concept of this really started with that conversation with William Morrell. So, Black Software, the first time I had ever seen those two words together was on a site by William Morrell that, was very old when I sort of found it. And it started with, and what I was trying to figure out when I first talked to William was, you know, what did you mean by that term? And, you know, William was, you know, at a certain point in time in his career, the only African-American computer store owner in Cambridge. And so he said he sold black software. And I wanted to understand what he meant. And, you know, the same question you asked me is what sort of vexed me at the beginning, which was how you conceive of software as being black and what I'm seeing, which is a material product, you call software. And so I really tried to understand that. And what ultimately came out of that was that at that time, what was being circulated, what William and others like Kamal al-Mansour were producing and selling were essentially clip art, at least one aspect of it. That is, digital representations of people and things. And the black software part of it came in to play because they reshaped these images, these digital images, to represent black people and black culture. And so it was a way of reshaping the existing digital content to reflect black people, black interests, black culture. And so that's where the concept came from, that I sort of stretched beyond that. But it, for me, was not about the hardware, although that was a part of it, but the idea to think about software really came about because this was the thing that black people were engaging with, and it was malleable. It was something that they could reshape. And so when you think about, I mean, when you go back to the, you know, the early 90s and look at websites and you think about all the GIF images that have sort of resurfaced with the animated GIFs of today of that particular image file type that was used and animated, and you see them, you know, dotting the landscape of black websites in the 90s. And that was utilized frequently because it was an easy type of file format to manipulate and to use. And so there again, here was a type of digital production, a type of code that could be shaped and reshaped and remade by people who knew how to engage it. And even as you go back earlier into the late 90s, or I'm sorry, the early 90s, late 80s, mid 80s, with things like the AfroNet, those folks were engaged with the hardware, and there was some connection to the kind of technical and tinkering nature of sort of engagement with this material thing. But what people were actually engaging with when they were connecting to other systems in the network, when they were connecting to other people in this distributed network, was the stuff, the content, the files, the code, the images that were being shared, sometimes some very, very, very rudimentary video, the text, all of which was a product of software. And so software for me had a lot to do not only with what people were actually engaging with technologically throughout the 90s, the 80s, 70s, and so forth. It conceptually for me was something about the malleable nature of what we design and what we sort of purposely produce. And to think about those things as being able to be influenced and shaped based on any one person's or group of people's interests. And so that concept for me then carries over back as we go to that sort of origin story, if you will, of Black software in the early 60s, to think again about not so much the computer, the hardware itself that starts to get developed in earnest in the early and mid 60s, but the what we are doing with those computers, which was had everything to do with software. And so as the story shifts from what are Black people doing to produce, engage, to connect to other Black folks across the country and across the world in the 80s, the 90s, and beyond, to ask the question in the 1960s, as computing is really starting to sort of take off and be developed and utilized amongst the public and in private settings, professional settings, government settings, to ask the question, how are we using this? That question was a software question, not a hardware question, because it had to do with what are we coding these new computers to do? What are we programming it to be able to do? What problems are we enabling it to solve? And all those questions were software questions. And the reason I always gravitated back to the software, because that's where your questions about intent and motivation and problem solving are all a part of that. So when you look at a software, a piece of software, software code or a program, embedded in that code, embedded in that program are all these questions about what problem are you trying to solve? What is the problem? Who is the problem? How are you defining it? And what are you enabling this software to do? And so that's what I was really interested in, is what are we mobilizing computers to be able to do? And all those for me were software question.
Right. So the first book, you talk about basically Black folks creating and deploying technology. Well, in the second book, your focus is more on how technology comes to be deployed on Black people. Would that be a fair kind of characterization?
Absolutely. And so the story, which, you know, I played with a lot in terms of the order, and in earlier versions of the manuscript, book two was book one and vice versa. Because I wanted to sort of properly represent how these two stories were related. And so I settled on the order that it's in now, because that is sort of the story. It's about a moment in the 60s where you have the development of the computer, of computing, but the virtual absence of Black folks, that you don't have Black folks at IBM and other computer companies that are developing the hardware and software. You don't have them in businesses and companies that are utilizing them. You don't have them represented in areas of government that are funding and that are compelling the uses of computing at that particular time. And so all of that then leaves open the door for those original computing systems to have a relationship to Black people as objects and not subjects. And so what gets created is used to thwart Black people. And the way that I set this up is to demonstrate the ways in which you have what is determined to be a problem-solving machine that then goes to look for what problems exist in the world. And what they find here in the 60s, of course, are Black people who are the nation's problem, and therefore become the problem for which the computer is designed to address, to solve, And so we start this pathway, a relationship of Black people to technology in that particular moment as objects having no real connection to the hardware, to the software, to the industry, to those who are making decisions about who it will be used or how it will be used. And so that's a beginning kind of a story that then after 10, 15, 20 and on years of development begins to shift. And so as you start to have more Black engineers, more Black software developers, more Black folks that are represented in the technology industry, still at very low levels, but you start to have folks who get access to that technology. And by gaining that access, begin to do something very differently with that technology than how it was originally designed. And so that's then where that book two comes from. And in many ways in that book, that's represented by the story of William Burrell, who is that connection to IBM, you know, who has very a sort of complicated connection to this whole story, but a Morrell who connects to an IBM that is exclusionary in many ways in the 1960s, very much a part of building these first computing systems that are built to ameliorate the threat of Black power, Black political agency, as it's playing out in the streets of the country in the 1960s. But then as that morphs into folks who gain access to that space, that corporate space, and to the digital tools that are being used in those spaces, begins to, you know, take that technology and use it for different purposes. And that's really the story of that moment in the 70s and the 80s, where you find African Americans who, you know, there were sort of kind of three arenas. Either you were in college or university and, you know, in engineering in some way. And so that's how you gain access to this technology. More often than not, it was folks like William Morrell who went to go work at IBM and gained access to that technology as a technician working for that company. And others were groups of folks who gained access by working for the federal government and had jobs that were jobs that gave them access to and experience with that technology. And so that story then begins to change as Black folks more and more gain access to that technology and are, you know, again, back to the software question, able to access and think about technology, which is something that is malleable and something that they find they can use and use for their own purposes to create community, to connect to other folks, so on and so forth. So that's how those two stories are connected, very much as you defined it, a story about how technology works on and certainly against Black people in its origins, and then how that changes to Black people gaining access to and power over that technology to use it and create things that are for us, that are by us, that are things that further our interests.
You frame the major question in the book as, will our current or future technology allow us to basically ever defeat white supremacy? And so my question to you is, like, looking at where we are right now with technology, so many movements, so many protests using technology, changing technology, going after tech companies that are misusing and governments who are misusing technology. Are we looking at an answer to that question? And if so, what do you think it is?
It's a good question and usually depends on the mood I'm in at the moment in terms of how I answer. But, you know, I'll be honest and frank. I set that question for me is the crux of the book, and it really has everything to do with that origin story and its juxtaposition to that story later about Black hobbyists and producers and so forth. And the story is this: if we start with the premise, as I do, that computing technology was explicitly designed to thwart Black people, Black power, Black interests. Not just as an afterthought, not as an unintended consequence, not as an inadvertent consequence, but a central design. So that's the origin. And if that is the origin, and that's how things play out from that moment in the 60s on, that is for computing, computer software, computer hardware, and all of its manifestations to be a check on Black agency, Black power, Black representation, Black political participation, then one has to question if it will and can ever be anything different. Black Lives Matter was that moment that made me think, that made many of us think, this is realistic. It is realistic to think that we can utilize, design, make, and mobilize this technology to fight the power, as it were. And Black Lives Matter was so exciting. It was so galvanizing. It was so moving as a movement because it showed us that possibility as a real possibility. But the question that I leave off with at the end of the book is that question: is this the pinnacle of our power, our digital, our technological power? And if it is, I think that does not bode well for that future. And so here's, you know, just one example of what I mean, which, you know, we've all sort of recognized now as we look back and reflect on, you know, those days in Ferguson and then in Baltimore and so many other places across the country where Black women, Black men were killed. The violence that was meted out against them by law enforcement and so forth. And we fought back and fought back in the streets and fought back using those digital tools. It was not long after we started moving or mobilizing those tools, Facebook in particular, and sort of organizing a lot of the movement and protests, organizing for Ferguson, Twitter, of course, for much of the rest of it, and the distributed protests that happened across the country. It was not long until you found law enforcement that had infiltrated those networks that were using social media data to surveil activist activity, in some cases to find people from Ferguson, from Berkeley, from New York City, Baltimore, who were on the streets that they then would go back and apprehend and arrest because of their involvement and the knowledge of that their involvement that they got from the social media networks. And so my point is that while there may be a temporary moment in which we mobilize technology towards these liberatory ends, there always seems to be the inevitable course correction. And that course correction that basically resets that relationship that says these are technologies that were not meant for you to be in control of, to own and to work for you. you found a way to sort of do that and to mobilize that for a moment, but we're back and we're back in control now. And we own this, we control this, we will ensure that it continues to get used for the purposes of maintaining a particular racial order and thwart your and our ability to do otherwise. So it's, you know, in some ways pessimistic, and in some ways, you know, sometimes I read that question that I lay out as a rhetorical one, because I don't see a different way that this happens or functions. On the other hand, it is a question that points to some possibility, and points to the possibility that if something like Black Lives Matter can happen, then surely there is at least some possibility that something even more powerful, even more revolutionary can happen. And so leaving out that hope, that possibility, I think is important. Number one, because it's real and it's evident and it's out there and we can see it. But at the same time, having the guarded optimism, the caution to know that, you know, computing was in a very real way designed to work against us and not for us.
To follow up with that, some folks give a very flip answer, and that is the solution is that we build our own stuff, right? What is your take on that idea?
I mean, I think that that is part of it. And I think one of the reasons that we have not been able to sort of mobilize technology towards these revolutionary ends, truly revolutionary ends, is because there is an ownership void. And that's one of the stark contrasts when we look at that moment, albeit brief, in the early mid 90s, where Black folks owned stuff in this digital space, that all seems to have virtually disappeared since. So I think ownership is one of them, and it is a challenge. And you know, you can look out on the world of you know, Black tech entrepreneurship and see the ways that Black entrepreneurs struggle to produce things, to gain a foothold in a market, to profit. So I think that's, you know, that is a real challenge. But it's not, I think the difference is not just about making our own stuff. It is about, you know, I guess I would have to say, you know, something like control. And when you think of the magnitude of the systems that are out there, your Googles of the world, your Microsoft, your Facebooks, your Twitters, etc., that really control so much of our lives, it's hard to see how simple production and creation, which we've always done as a community and have had a sort of an outsized role in, what we haven't had is that sense of prominence and power, or even, you know, domination in a way, and domination in a market context, in a financial context. And so I think that is the ownership challenge, the ownership handle. So ownership is one thing, but then going from simple owner to being a major player that influences and controls in a way the trajectory of not only the technology, but you know, the culture and the behavior that goes along with that. I think that's where the gap is. And I think it's an extraordinary gap.
So what do you hope people take away from Black software?
I want people to know, first and foremost, that when we look out on this thing that is what we are immersed in today, this internet and everything that is connected to it, our whole digital environment, for people to know and realize that Black people are as much a part of the history of that medium's development as are the white folks that are typically held up as its heroes. When you read, you know, popular books about the internet, you see, you just see a litany of white folks and white men in particular. And these are the folks we hold out as the creators, the innovators, the people who originated these technologies and the hardware and the software. And that's who we build up. And I think what we miss is the fact that Black people shaped that technology, you know, in many ways more than those folks that we hold out. And so, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, up until the early 90s, the internet was, you know, a bunch of you know, pipes and cables and hardware and a place where average folks had no connection to and no reason to utilize it. And even when the World Wide Web came online, there was nothing there. There was no connection. And so as this thing moved from government and sort of government and private enterprise tool to a public commercial tool that needed masses of users, we only made that transition because of Black people. That Black folks were the cultural producers in that space that made the internet something that people wanted to come to, that there was content that was exciting, that was new, that was engaging. And that is what we built. And if we look at the internet today, where everything is about that engagement, that excitement, that attention, and we see that as a real driver of the digital economy, that is something that we are directly responsible for. So first and foremost, I want us and I want people to know that we are here, that we were there when this stuff was created, that we have a giant role, even if it is untold and uncelebrated, that it should be. And the second is really, as we think about all that we have done and can do with these technologies, I want us to, I want readers to be realistic about the possibilities and the limits of this technology. And so I want people to think about where all of this came from. I want people to think about the origin story of the internet, the origin story of computing, and to think about what it means to frame computing as a tool of white supremacy, as a racialized tool from its very beginnings and origins, and temper our expectations, our possibilities, and so forth, knowing that this was something that was always meant to limit our agency, our power, our influence.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.